This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the Bunker Daily. I'm Andrew Harrison. Today, cryptocurrency, the digital money that we were told was going to free the world from the tyranny of banks, cut fraud, lead to seamless transactions around the world, and enable the unbanked, or people who couldn't get access to financial services, to get power over their own money. The idea was it would give power back to the people. Unfortunately, the sector has also been hit with criminality and volatility. Losses from cryptocurrency crime reached $4.52 billion in 2019, largely from insider theft rather than hacking, according to a report from blockchain forensics company Cypher. Trace. In July, Twitter hackers posed as Elon Musk to fake a giveaway of Bitcoin, the world's largest cryptocurrency. And things are wild even on the legitimate market. This week, Bitcoin reached a high of $12,100 per coin before collapsing with over $1 billion in sell-off. It is a bewildering world. So where is cryptocurrency now? Should we trust it or should we treat it as a money laundering scheme, as the CEO of BlackRock recently claimed? Here to help me with my ignorance is Philip Nunn, the CEO of WealthChain Capital, a blockchain and tech fund. He's a regular speaker on the cryptocurrency and blockchain circuits. Hello, Philip. How are you doing?
Hi. Thanks. Nice to see you. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Not bad. Thanks for joining us. So, as I explained, I need help with my ignorance. First off, what is it and how does it work? I have a vague idea. You know, value is mined by continuing calculations on a network of computers, all decentralized. Can you give me the layman's idiot explanation of what this is? Because I'm a layman and an idiot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's probably quite fitting as a starting point, because my whole basis of entering into the blockchain and cryptocurrency space happened about 7 years ago. And I'm not a techie. And that was initially very rare in crypto, because the whole industry was built on guys who were techies, who understood sort of the deep dive and, you know, the cryptography elements and how, distributed ledgers work and the technical aspects of that. But it's, if you go down those rabbit holes, it's extremely complicated and it's a very dry learning topic. So there's two ways I really explain it when I talk to people about it. The first one is what you're essentially doing with the advent of cryptocurrency is you're going back to, I guess, like almost where bartering currencies were, where you actually have the ability to transact value. And I say value very loosely. That doesn't have to be money. That can be data, sensitive information, a whole manner of things. And you're actually exchanging that value without the need for a third party in the middle, like a middleman. So that would be something like if you wanted to transact data for your passport, it wouldn't need a server in the middle. So effectively, that's going from A to B on an independent blockchain. And when you talk about monetary things, it would be that you're actually removing the need for a bank in the middle to process, or something like a Western Union money transfer to process that transaction. So that's the first side of it. And the second thing I say, which is I think probably more understandable sort of day to day, is we've had the advent of the Internet of Information. And what that has been is a platform for people to instantly communicate with data with each other. So I can send you an email if you're in Australia, and that can happen in a millisecond. And it's unbelievable that we have that ability to do that. What's essentially then happened is we've thought, okay, so what would be great is if we actually move transactional things like buying things and shopping and changing money and exchanging value online. But it's almost like the biggest sort of square peg in a round hole is trying to apply that monetary system to the Internet of Information. It just really doesn't fit. And where there's a big sort of discrepancy in terms of the fit is where really cybercrime happens, because the Internet of Information is an open source platform, and it can be hacked. Everything can be hacked. Data can be taken. So from a security point of view, that's really the thing. So what cryptography does, and distributed ledgers and the advent of blockchain technology, and even if you sort of come away from crypto for a second, is it just offers a much more secure way to transact those bits of information. So it really is a true internet of value. So that's sort of probably, I don't know if that's probably confused you and your listeners more, but that's sort of how I explain it.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, so I suppose the key issue that people would bring up would be, if you're taking out the intermediaries, well, the intermediary is not just something that takes a fee. The intermediary provides protection for the transactors and is regulated and is happening, you know, out in the open and is happening within national boundaries. So you know, a banking system is controlled by a government. It is regulated. There are consumer protections there. And you're saying that in place of those statutory protections, there is an uncrackable blockchain that maintains the integrity of the transaction.
Yep. So that again, that sort of raises a really interesting sort of argument. And I've always maintained that. So look, what happened with cryptocurrency was, let's say you compare cryptocurrency to the advent of .com, which was all the tech giants being born. You know, we had the .com bubble where trillions and trillions of dollars, it was mainly European and US money, went into all these tech companies, and they were the next big thing. And ultimately they have become the next big thing, but you have to have a bubble that happens. That was mainly driven by Wall Street and, you know, the city in London, and a lot of investment came from those areas. Whereas crypto was the other way around. It was really born out of the crowd, and it was born out of a movement of people that said, well, you know, we're not satisfied with how things are at the moment. And this is where a lot of the issues and, credibility issues that the space has had is that the crowd were first. And you've got all these guys that were saying, you know, whole new world, let's pile into Bitcoin. This is going to be the next big thing. And we're going to disrupt and overhaul financial systems and processes and, as you say, governance and regulation. And that was simply never going to happen. So you were always going to have this sort of peak of interest and then a massive blow up in terms of reputation because of the way the roadmap worked. Now, I think we're in a really fascinating time for crypto at the moment. We're sort of at a juncture where I think traditional channels are unable to ignore it now, number one. And albeit they'll come out and sort of mock it, and as you say, you know, BlackRock have come out with a very strong opinion. I know JP Morgan came out with a very strong opinion, then we're caught to be trading the life out of it in that trading, which is actually on record and true. And Jamie Dimon had to backtrack massively on his opinions of it. So my opinion was always that, look, you know, this is going to take a long time. There's going to be adoption because the reality is it is the internet of value. It's like Web 3.0, but it's not going to be on the terms of we're going to overhaul regulators and financial systems. That's never going to happen. However, what you are starting to see now are that governments, banks, institutions, whole nations, if you look at China, they're actually looking at building their own, cryptocurrency at the moment. People are looking at this for the integration of cashless societies. And this is a much safer way for people to store values, as simple as that. So it was always going to be on the terms of when the big banks and governments and people like that wanted to get involved. So that's where where we're slowly moving to now.
But I mean, there have been some pretty kind of high profile, shall we say, unfortunate incidents ranging from, you know, out and out crime. I think, was it Mt. Gox lost £430 million pounds to theft? Certain startups have turned out to be, you know, nothing more than pyramid schemes. And, you know, as you're saying, it's like the new people through the door. It's disruption on an enormous scale. And there is undoubtedly criminality involved. Warren Buffett's compared them to Ponzi schemes. How compromised by bad actors is crypto at the moment, do you think?
Well, I'll give you an interesting story that happened to me a week ago, and then I'll answer the actual question. Mm-hmm. So there's a very prominent cryptocurrency called Tron, which is the founder and CEO of Tron is a chap called Justin Sun. And he actually paid, I think it was $2 million to have lunch with Warren Buffett. And I think he was trying to get him on board with the crypto revolution. It was quite
Is this Eat Out to Help Out?
I think Warren Buffett does a charity thing every year. Right? Yeah, pull him in, yeah. So tie him up to some... So who knows what Warren Buffett's up to. But So I got a reach out from Justin Sun's personal email address. And because I will talk to you a bit more about the, I've had the same Elon Musk scam happen to me actually on LinkedIn, because I've got 300,000 followers on LinkedIn. So I've had it happen to me where people have lost money, people scamming, etc. So what happened was I got an email from Justin Sun's personal email address and sent it through, looked very legitimate. We booked a Skype call from his proper Skype, and I was like, this is sort of a bit strange. And he said, oh, you know, you're a prominent guy in the space, we're looking to do this. And I got on the Skype call, and it was like a piece of artificial intelligence, the Skype, and it was like it was Justin Sun's face, but you could clearly see it was somebody else behind the face. It was like, like the left-hand side of the face looked like it had had a bit of like Bell's palsy or a stroke or something. I was like, hang on, what is going on here? So there were some guys talking to me on Skype, and they'd managed to put a sort of face over of, wow, of one of the biggest guys in crypto, and they were trying to get me to invest in the next wave of Tron's investment.
So it's like, not so much a deep fake as a crap fake.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and you know, look, there are bad actors in any industry. And if you put it into context, I mean, cybercrime in globally in the world, if you talk about the normal monetary system, will top $3 trillion this year. So it's not exclusive to crypto, but you're absolutely right. The issue is that this was a kids in their bedroom having a bit of fun, throwing some money into some new concept, and all of a sudden it's got a, you know, billions and billions of dollars of market cap. And yeah, you know, because it's so loose and unregulated, and people deem it that it's all anonymous, then you do get bad actors coming into the space. So look, you know, that is going to happen, but it's at the start, it's still in its infancy. You know, this the internet's been around for what, 30, 35 years? Mm. And it took a long time to get any kind of adoption. And now imagine the world trying to live without the internet. So yeah, I think it's, I personally think it's a really exciting time. And actually, the more progressive jurisdictions, if you look at places like Canada, they're excellent. Places like Malta, places like Switzerland, a lot of them are now embracing this as, look, yeah, it's coming. We know this is coming. I had a meeting with some guys in Jersey last week. They're the largest trust company in Jersey. They now do tokenized assets as one of their things for traditional businesses. Mm. And they've done like £300 million worth of transactions in the last year. So to say that it's not on the map now, you know, it would be a misstatement, really. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There have been some massive blow-ups, but it does happen across the board. It's just where money is involved, it is what happens.
So my question would be, in a conventional financial environment, there'd be regulators in plain sight appointed by governments who would be addressing these issues. With a distributed system like this, there is no authority. There's no Lord Crypto out there who can go and convene an inquiry. What are the legitimate actors within the sector doing about this? Or is it being entirely left to national jurisdictions, fraud investigation departments?
Well, it's an interesting question again. And I think the problem is, and I've talked extensively to regulators about this over the years, is that they can't regulate what they don't understand. So that's been the biggest challenge so far, because it is such a new innovative concept, people can't get their head around it, first of all, and it does take a while to do that. So if you actually look at the biggest and most prominent people in the space, everybody is screaming for regulation. You know, we want regulation, we want oversight, we want guidance, we want to know what's right and what's wrong. And I think we're in that phase at the moment. So if you look at the Bitcoin Foundation, they're very collaborative and they work closely with regulators. And another point I'll make as well, if you sort of, you know, if you go right back to, so let's say someone like Pablo Escobar, right? You know, people say, well, if Bitcoin was around now, he'd have found it so much easier to move his billions around and he'd have, you know, done this and done that. And that's just simply not true, because the Bitcoin blockchain is not an anonymous blockchain. Whilst it's secure and you can't hack it, you can see where the transactions are going. So there you do have people that can track transactions and see the history and what's happening on the Bitcoin blockchain, which in my mind is much more secure for regulators than, you know, someone dropping holdalls of dollars out of aeroplanes over harvested fields, you know.
Or indeed numbered bank accounts in certain banking jurisdictions that consider to be entirely legitimate, I would imagine.
Well, exactly, yeah. And there is an argument to say that, you know, I mean, is there a movement from higher powers that this is the next wave of the Swiss bank account?
Yeah.
Is it the next thing? And there are going to be ways that people shield their assets via these things. And I think the real squeeze has been on, you know, the privacy coins like Nero and coins like that. The ones that are on very unhackable anonymous blockchains, they've really had the brunt of the regulators, because this just doesn't work, because this does open itself up to funding terrorism, money laundering, shielding assets. So, but I guess the answer to the question is that a very collaborative approach, yes. All of the big leaders in the space are saying, look, all we're trying to do is reinvent the internet so it's safer. That's the main thing we're doing here. And then I guess what you sort of have to separate Bitcoin. You know, I liken Bitcoin to, it's like a Banksy. It's not really a commodity. It's not really money. It's not really anything. It's kind of like, well, no one knows who made it or what it is, but it's worth a load of money. I think it's the Banksy of money. I think it's fantastic.
Although, to be fair, if you go down any market in Liverpool or Manchester or London, you'll find knockoff Banksys as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, exactly.
I presume you'll say that there's no blockchain behind the Banksy ensuring that the Banksy is a legit Banksy. But from what you've mentioned here, because there are several different cryptocurrencies, I wanted to ask you, Bitcoin is the best known one. A, is it the most secure? And B, what is the kind of, what's the environment of other competing cryptocurrencies? Are there particular currencies that are known for this purpose or for that purpose, and certain ones that are perhaps known for shadiness? I mean, some of our listeners will have heard the brilliant BBC podcast, The Missing Crypto Queen, about Ruja Ignatova and her OneCoin scam, which proved to be, you know, a kind of essentially a criminal enterprise. Give me an idea of the kind of the taxonomy of the Bitcoin world.
Well, I mean, obviously you have, you know, the sort of the godfather and the basis of this whole thing, you know, the Satoshi paper, which led to this. I think Bitcoin is on the map as a real store of data and value now. It's unquestionable. Just to give you an idea, to hack one chain of the Bitcoin blockchain, so to unravel it and see you know, exactly get the details and what's happened and steal the money, you would need 30 times the computation power of Google's servers to hack that. So it's pretty secure stuff. So Bitcoin's there. Bitcoin will kind of chug along. It's never been the most innovative of cryptocurrencies. It's never been the most out there, but it's got the will of the people and it's got adoption and it's a global thing. You know, people will always know what Bitcoin is now worldwide, even if you're a cleaner or a hotelier or whoever you are, or you know, whatever you do. If people say Bitcoin, you go, yeah, I know about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So it's done its job. It's put crypto on the map. And as I said, I think it's this strange one in like 20, 30 years. If you actually look at the use cases for gold, I mean, gold nowadays is fundamentally useless, isn't it? It's all every investment is sentiment driven. It's as simple as that. So you have, you know, you can't go to the shop with a bar of gold and buy a new car. It's just, you know, it's not, so, but actually, because of the value we pin to it, if you have gold, you store it. So it's a similar sort of thing, and it does get referred to as digital gold. I wouldn't quite call it that. So, and then underneath, you have various different cryptocurrencies, from Ethereum to Ripple to Doge to Tron to, I mean, you can list them and list them. And what they usually do, they sort of have their own use case. So Ethereum is the blockchain of blockchains. So if you're actually looking to build something that's decentralized on an app, it's almost like a plug and play solution. So you build on that. It's almost like building on you know, like Java, or building on a website generator, but it's got that security to do that. And then Ripple is kind of being deemed as the banker's coin. There's a lot of controversy around that. So they're all kind of finding a niche underneath things that exist. So it's almost like you know, this one would compete with PayPal, or this one would compete with gold, or this one would compete with data security. So there's a real sort of plethora of it. But much like anything, as I said, we're in the dot-com phase for crypto. So this is going to be, most of them won't survive. You'll have your MySpaces and your, you know, I'm trying to think of other.
How about Hotel and Friends Reunited and things like that vanished?
Exactly. Yeah.
Not everything's going to be Facebook.
Yeah, they spawned Facebook, and you know, I mean, Friends Reunited. I mean, what did they? That was unbelievable. That platform. I mean, they made a right hash of that, didn't they?
You mentioned that China is setting up crypto, other countries are setting up their own crypto operations. I believe the Maduro government created one to evade US sanctions, the Petro, I read somewhere. Does crypto have the potential to undermine the integrity of the international banking and exchange system? Because if you can avoid tax, essentially, possibly even by saying, well, it's not really money, it's something else. Does this have the potential to kind of chip away at the foundations of an international financial system that's already, often through its own actions, put itself in a pretty shaky place?
Well, yeah, it's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously in the Western world, we only get sort of the you know, our institutionalized side of that story and the argument. And it was a bit of a sort of two fingers up to almost the US institutions and the dollar, and the Petro was a really interesting sort of scenario that played out. And they were never going to win that battle. Of course, they were never going to win that battle. But yeah, I mean, I saw an article yesterday that said that the stimulus, the package that's going into the US at the moment, is it something like $1 million a minute is being pumped into their economy? Essentially, there is a bigger argument, if you are really getting into the nuts and bolts of this, that every single one of these recessions, and I think this is going to be a depression, I think on your footnotes there you said we're in this 300-year, once-in-300-year recession. We're in a situation where currencies are being devalued, and is there a scenario where the dollar almost is dethroned, where other parts of the world where the dollar is pretty much the first currency? You know, I've traveled to places like Vietnam and parts of Africa and, you know, South America, and they prefer the US dollar than any other currency. They don't want to trade at their own currency. So if you actually look at that logically, the buying power of the dollar, the dollar's effectively worth zero. They've printed trillions of dollars of stimulus during this pandemic. So they're continually devaluing. So where does that end? You know, and fiat currencies traditionally always have a cycle. They always have a life cycle and collapse at some point. So it does beg the question, which is why you're seeing gold, again, as usual, being seen as a massive hedge. People are hedging over to gold. We live in a very different world now. So where are the future hedges that people go to? And is that Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency or something similar that maybe does have the will of the people and the authorities? And the essence of that is that because of it's a supply limit. So, you know, Bitcoin is divisible by, I think, sort of 10, 20, you know, decimal points. So you can split it as much as you want. So it's not an issue in terms of supply, but there's only ever so many Bitcoins that are going to be in existence. So once they're consumed, they're consumed. So it has to create a deflationary currency. Whereas the dollar, because you're flooding the money supply, at some point inflation has to catch up to that. And that's when we have the real problems. This is going to get this is like nothing any of our parents, grandparents, or great grandparents ever saw. This sort of recession we're going to go through is going to be a new thing for everyone. It's just absolutely bonkers.
Yeah. Just in closing, then, just to kind of bring it back, maybe to the person sitting at their keyboard and at their terminal. We've all heard horror stories of people who've unwisely piled in to various different cryptocurrencies, and the OneCoin scam was a real standout. What's your advice? Is this the kind of thing that a person with a small portfolio of money ought to be playing with, or are the risks too great, and is it too complicated to fully understand? Are you better off with your ISA?
Well, again, it's a really interesting question. So if I didn't know anything about crypto, absolutely nothing at all, I may be inclined to say, look, you know, I'm going to buy half a Bitcoin and just leave it for 10 years. And that's a punt. And that's absolutely a punt. But what I'd liken it to is, many years ago, I worked in the city. I worked in London for a long time. And when we were building portfolios for clients at that time, we said, right, there's this thing you can't ignore, and you need to have 5% of it in your portfolio, because the growth, hockey stick growth, it's aggressive. There's a spike. It's a new economy. It's going crazy. So this was in 2003, and it was called China, right?
Right.
Honestly, that was the situation. They'll never catch on. Yeah, it's not going to work. And the issue was in China that the whole stock market was 30 companies only on it, and it was owned by the government, and they could throw it all to zero at any time, and this, this, and this, and they're a communist state. But you couldn't ignore the growth. And I think that's what's starting to happen with crypto and certainly Bitcoin, is that when the pandemic was announced and markets tumbled, Bitcoin tumbled with it, because there are a lot of smaller hedge funds, family offices, institutions that have exposure to cryptocurrency now. It is happening, and the banks do too. I predict in the next maybe 2 or 3 years, and some are starting to do it anyway, I predict that you'll be able to select a cryptocurrency portfolio through Hargreaves Lansdown on your ISA or AJ Bell or whoever it is. And that is going to happen. So, you know, for your man on the street, for me, I just learn about it for now. I think the biggest knowledge is to learn about it and maybe not get exposure to it as yet. But if I had to put a Bitcoin under my pillow for 10 years, I think you'd do very well.
Fair enough. Well, yeah. Philip, thanks very much for joining us. That's been fascinating. And I feel I understand it a bit more, but it is by nature immensely complicated. I'm off to that landfill in California to try and find the hard drive with $127 million on it. Is it real, or was that a myth, or was it real?
No, that was real. That was absolutely genuine. That was real, yeah. So once it's gone, it's gone. That's the scarcity thing, you see. So, but yeah, I mean, crypto cybersecurity is going to be a huge thing, isn't it? You know, cold storage. It says, you know, actually, ironically, if you strip it back, the safest place to store your wallet key is on a piece of paper.
Right. Okay.
In a vault. Another vault in a mountain in Switzerland.
Yeah, and then you need a password for the vault. It's making my head spin. Philip, really good talk to you. Thanks for joining us, listeners. Remember, there's a new Bunker Daily on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, with the main panel podcast on Wednesdays, and you can get the podcast early and without adverts, plus smart Bunker merchandise too, when you back us on Patreon. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Philip, and we'll see you soon.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production was by me, Alex Reese. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.